Accession number 19060, Reel 4.
Jim Murray, Reel 4.
Yeah, we went by VOSC to supposedly Nairobi, but the plane caught fire over Egypt and we had to make a forced landing at Cairo, where the VOSC treated us for the full weekend. We saw the pyramids and the Sphinx. Although I'd been in Egypt before, I'd never seen the pyramids because we're on the canal all the time. And we had a lovely weekend there prior to getting on board again and landing at Entebbe in Uganda and then on to Nairobi. We found the police school was full, so they decided to send us up country.
Who were you with? On the journey out?
On the journey out, just with this Roy Ellison. Well, there's lots of people, but he was the one I was sitting with, he was the one I knew. But there was quite a number of people joining the Kenya police at that time. Various ranks. I think I was the lowest rank, mind, a full corporal, I think, in as far as the armed services went. And so they decided to ship us, split us up and send us up country. And so I was given a 45 revolver with 10 rounds of ammunition, Sam Brown, and so much khaki material to have me uniforms made up when I got there. So that was the whole, that was it. I was then sent up to Molo, which is 25 miles beyond Nakuru, and up the Rift Valley area.
How do you spell Molo?
M-O-L-O.
And what, do you know the dates of this about?
It would be 50, the 56, I think, 55, end of 55, 56, 50, begin the 56, I think.
So you were going up to Molo?
Yes, and we settled in there at Molo.
What was there at Molo?
It was a small township in the White. It was the White Highlands of Kenya, and it reminded you a lot of Scotland, with stone walls and pine trees and all that. And they grew that. What do you call it? What they make DDT out of, those daisy-like flowers, you know, pyrethrum. They used to grow pyrethrum flowers by the hundreds of acres, and they could get two crops a year. It was worth a fortune. And I was living in the Highlands Hotel, which was really a posh hotel, and it was beyond me. I mean, I hardly knew which knife and fork to use at the time, you know, retired matrons and all that living there.
And were you at a police station at Molo?
Yes, it was the headquarters for that area. And we were just like looking in and helping out here, dog's bodies really, waiting for the school to open, you know. But a Geordie man there, who had run away from home when he was a boy, he had a butchery and a bakery there in Molo, and he gave me this big house free of charge. And so my friends and I moved into this big house close to the bakery. We had free bread and free meat, and we had no expenses to pay. So what money we earned was ours.
Had you gone to Molo for training then?
No, we were waiting for the school for a new course to start. And then we would join we'd be called eventually. They reckoned about 3 months. But something happened up at a place called Del Dharma Ravine, where there's a bloke, an inspector there, he liked his drink quite a bit, and things were getting on top of him. And they decided to send me to help out. And within the first day I was there, this is where pseudo gang leader came home to El Dharma Ravine with these hands, and he asked for hot soapy water, and I honestly thought it was for to wash his own hands and face. And we got the black But the gentleman to fetch the policeman to fetch the soapy water, and he just untied this black bag, and out fell these curled up, crooked little hands. All, and they went and got the identification fingerprint kit, and we had to massage these little hands until they were pliable, and fingerprint them all. And then I was told that they were whisked off to, they'd be whisked off to Nairobi, and we'd know exactly who to rub off the list within 24 hours. And that was my first experience of a really traumatic sort of thing, like, you know, early on before I'd even gone to the school, you know.
And who was this pseudo gang member?
That was Kenny Jackson. He's a Yorkshire lad, and he was a quite a cool customer, and he'd had the George Medal, he'd been awarded the George Medal, and he's a real tough cookie.
Which part of Yorkshire did he come from?
Oh, I couldn't tell you now, couldn't remember now.
And was he disguised as a Kikuyu?
He disguised as a terrorist, yes, they do that, yeah.
What was his disguise? What did he look like?
Well, just wool blankets and his face was all daubed and all that, but coming into us, he'd more or less rubbed a lot of it off, sort of thing, you know.
Did he look like a Kikuyu?
Oh yes, he had a wig and all that sort of thing, yeah, like tattered ringlets and all that sort of thing. Oh yeah, but apparently when he was out there, he used to use his chief pseudo Kikuyu to do the talking, and he used to act as a deaf mute and always looking down, sort of thing. And at the time, the natives there used to give them a wide berth, anyhow, people of that were strangely different to what they were.
But presumably his features would be sharp European features rather than flat.
No, they weren't. They weren't. They were actually round. He was very round, and his nose was round as well. The only thing was the eye colour. You know, the eye colour was different.
What colour was it?
It was like a blue eye instead of a brown eye, you know.
And the hands were hands of enemy who had been killed.
And that was the economical way of doing it. I mean, the predators or the dustbin men, more or less what we call of Africa, the ants and the hawks and the hyenas and all them, they follow you. The liquids is running out of the body, and you it's difficult to carry, and you'd have to put them up a tree at night, and even then it wouldn't be safe, you know. The animals would still be attracted to them, so that was the only way you could do it. But it was stopped shortly after that. And I think Bessie Braddock was the person who complained about it and had it stopped. But it wasn't a case of brutality, it was just an economical way of doing it. They were dead anyhow.
And you had to massage them to make them flexible.
Yeah, well, three or four of us got down and had to rub these, get them out of that rigor mortis state, sort of thing, so they could be fingerprinted.
Was that easily done?
It took a while. It took a while to do.
How many other hands were there?
Well, I think there's about seven, eight pair.
Was it Ken Taylor you said he was called?
Ken Jackson.
Ken Jackson. Did Ken Jackson speak to you then and tell you about what he'd been doing?
Not at that particular time. He doesn't tell you. Later on, we had like a sort of a get together. It was that house where we were in Morlaw. It was had nice big rooms, and we used to have a get togethers there, like all the inspectors and chief inspectors. And have a good old boozy session, and it was there he'd tell us bits and pieces, like, you know, of his in fact, the latter stage he had to get out pretty quick.
Why was that?
Because they thought he was going too far that way.
In what sense?
Well, he was too aggressive. He got out the city. He was given 24 hours to get out the country. Anyhow.
By whom?
By the chief superintendent.
And you say this place was called El Dama Ravine. How do you spell that?
E L D A M A, and Ravine.
And that's where you met him, was it?
That's where I first met him. Yeah, I'd gone to help this other fellow at the El Dama Ravine, and El Dama Ravine just happened to be the nearest police post to where he'd made the contact, you know. And it was like an outpost of Molo, you know, if you see what I mean. Molo was the headquarters, and El Dama Ravine was one of the outposts, sort of thing.
What else happened to you next?
Well, I was called to the school then, to the police school, and that was at Neary, which is more or less at the foot of Mount Kenya. And while I was there, I decided to box for the police. Well, I was boxing for myself, really. It was individual championships, and the police allowed me time off to box, and I got right through to the semi-finals, and I was beaten in the semi-finals in boxing in Nairobi, and I was the only police inspector fighting. There was all sorts. There was Army, Air Force, King's African Rifles, all sorts.
Who beat you?
I can't remember his name now, but he went on to win the championship. This bloke, he was winning his fights in one or two punches, and I was winning my fights in two rounds. But it went three rounds, and I was pretty badly cut inside. Not my nose never broke, but it used to cut inside, and I was swallowing a lot of blood. And but there's a fella there that had a garage called Migdal Motors, and he came across to me and wanted to buy me out of the police and take up professional boxing. He said I had a gift, but I ignored it and carried on with the police. Anyhow, I passed out of the police school after 3 months, and it was quite a... We had to learn all about the penal code and the Indian Evidence Act. We had to learn the Swahili language, and enough to be able to converse anyhow, you know. And I got through all that, and then they sent me to the Aberdare Mountains, and the divisional headquarters was Athyre. And when I got there, there was a Chief Inspector Bissett was there. He's a big Scotsman, 6 foot odd, and he had big fat legs, and the natives used to call him Bwana Dofu, Mr. Elephant. And of course, they'd heard all about my boxing before I got there, you see, and it was like a fair taking place at the time. So what they'd done, they'd set up a ring, and all the chiefs and all their bodyguards were coming to their fair, and I hadn't a clue about this. So they went, "Oh, well done, Jim, come in," and all this sort of thing. And they took us to the bar and had a couple of pints, and we said, come and see what's happening. They were having races and all this, that and the other. And they had spear throwing competitions, bow and arrow competitions, and all that sort of thing. And it was good to watch. Like, anyhow, there was these four posts with rope around it. And I says, "What's this?" And oh, he says, "This is where you're performing today, you know. You're going to take on all comers." I said, "Oh, yeah." So but I had a couple of drinks anyhow. I says, "Well, I wouldn't mind once or twice, but I says, not all comers, you know." So he said to his chiefs, he said to these chiefs that were collected with the blokes there with the shotguns and spears, he says, "Is anybody would like to punch the white man? Pigayang Gumi, I forget the exact, but Piga with Ngozi, which is leather. Strike the man with leather," or the way they put it, you know. And oh, there was one or two volunteers, like you say, so, but they hadn't a clue with their gloves on, you know, they hadn't a clue at all. And I was just standing there, bopping them on the nose, making the nose bleed. And, oh, so somebody else would come along, like, and the chiefs were trying to urge the bodyguards on, like, but after I'd done a couple of them, nobody was Nobody was interested then. I was pleased, like, I didn't want to be doing it. So that was my introduction to Athaya. And then they sent me from Athaya to a place called Mahiga, which was further up the mountain. And Frank Travis was running Mahiga.
Is this down in the Aberdares?
In the Aberdare Mountains, yeah. And I thought I was going to be working there. But the next day they said, we're going to take you up to the outpost now, and you're going to a little village 13,000 feet up called Munyangi. And Inspector Robbins is up there, and you take over from him. He's leaving today, or tomorrow. And so that was it. I went up to this place in Munyangi, and there's a village at the mud and wattle houses. But I was on a hill. My village was on a hill. My camp was on a hill. And it was surrounded by a big moat with bamboo stakes in, with a drawbridge over, and barbed wire fence all around it. And it was just a little mud and wattle house, and a kitchen for the native to cook my meals. A drill square at the front, and about 10 mud and wattle rondavels, the round houses, where the families lived with the constables. And that was going to be my home. And Inspector Robbins showed it. I took over everything except one hut. And I said, what about this hut? I never looked in this hut. Oh, he says, these are yours as well. And he opened the door, and there's three black girls there. He says, these are my wives. He says, the chief sent them up, you know. I said, oh, get rid of them. New brush sweeps clean. I got rid of them. Sent them back to the village, which was a disgrace, apparently, because it was an honour then for them to be, for the elders to send their daughters to the Mzungu, the European. And so Robbins left, and there was me with very little experience up in the Aberdare Mountains, because the Kikuyu people had been shoved into the mountains as a reserve to try to contain them, like, you know, to keep the active Mau Mau away from them.
So you were surrounded by Kikuyu?
All Kikuyu, yeah. And then I had a fella come to the door once, and he was in a real poverty-stricken state. And his name was Jamrik, and he was Maskini. He was a poor man. Maskini means poor, poverty. And I found out why. I took him in, fed him, and he was half Kikuyu and half Maasai. Because the Maasai used to raid the Kikuyu people and rape and pillage. And he was the result of one of these rapes. And so I kitted him out with my European clothes, like. And good, it was like giving him $1 million, like, you know. And I showed him, I don't think he'd seen a mirror before. I had a big full-length mirror in the dressing table, and I was coming short so he could look at himself with my European clothes on, you know. And he used to cut me timber and for the fire, do any odd jobs for us and all that. As being a half caste in Kikuyu land, he wasn't allowed to marry, and he wasn't allowed any land. He wasn't allowed to own Kikuyu land, so he hadn't a chance of. And he used to work in the Nairobi, but because of the Mau Mau trouble, he was shipped out. And I said, well, what sort of job did you do? He says, I'm a picky fundy. And I said, well, picky. And apparently a picky was a motorbike. Picky. Well, if they didn't have a name for it, they gave it a name, you know. So he was an expert on motorbikes. Well, there wasn't many up there in Kikuyu country. So
was he telling the truth?
Oh, yes, he was. He worked in Nairobi as motorbike mechanic. Yeah.
But you used him for work?
I used him for work and looked after him. I protected him. He lived within the compound. And also, I used to have a boy whose father was a gang leader. Stanley Mathengi was the gang leader's name. He was a head teacher before the Mau Mau, and before he went into the forest. And both his parents lived in Munyangi, and both were blind. And his own son lived with the grandparents, the blind grandparents, until he was being threatened by some, whether it was the Home Guard, because there was a Home Guard there which were loyal to the Brits. So I brought him into the compound, and he lived with me quite a while in the compound. But Stanley Mathenge, he never came out of the forest. And they think Dayton Camarthy killed him. Why, Dayton Camarthy was caught in my area by this special branch bloke. He claimed catching him. But in actual fact, he was shot by the Home Guards. They shot him. He was having sex in a banana plantation when the Home Guards caught onto him. And they shot him in the leg, but he still ran about 7 miles after he'd been shot. But this bloke claimed that, and he wrote the book, I Captured Dayton Camarthy. I don't know if you've ever read it, but he wrote that. I saw that book years later.
And this happened in your area?
And he was disturbed in my area, and he was on his way out of my area when he was caught by the Home Guard. And he was executed, he was hung. But he was a real violent man. He used to love killing his own men. He used to have a rope, he used to make them kneel down, and he used to strangle them, kneel them down. For the pettiest of crimes, the least little crime, at the height of the Mau Mau, he had about 18 or 20 women in a harem. That travelled with him, but he was riddled with every venereal disease you could think of, dropping to bits, literally.
But he was operating in your area whilst you were a policeman there?
Yes, yeah. And he was the last big leader to be caught. He was the last big leader to be caught.
And was it your job to try to catch him?
It was my job. We used to do a fortnight patrolling and a fortnight around the villages. So we spent a fortnight patrolling the villages and a fortnight patrolling the bush. And that was our major, but I didn't catch him, you know. We didn't catch him. But at the same time, they had gangs in there hunting them. And if there was a team actually in the forest, we would be told by radio to keep out or watch the forest edges or whatever, you know. Yeah.
Did you ever find or come across anything on these patrols?
Yeah, we come across all the snares and all that sort of thing, you know. But these people were not aggressive people. They were aggressive with their own kind. We came across a village where these four or five women had been killed. One or two of them were pregnant, and they'd been cut open, and the fetus removed, and the spear standing in the baby's. Threw the baby into the ground, you know. There was some terrible atrocities that way. And they used to chuck them into the deep trench latrines. They chuck them head first, blokes down head first, where there's all sorts of bugs down there, you know. And they'd eat the flesh off within days. When you got down to it, there'd only be bone left. Yeah.
But they weren't adopting aggressive tactics towards the authorities.
By the time I got there, We've got this one fella in, and he was saying the gangs were so terrified of the pseudo gangs, they wouldn't meet or mix with their own true kind even. They wouldn't mix with anyone because there'd been so many where they joined forces, and one was the pseudo gang, and the pseudo gang had killed them. The minute they relaxed, the pseudo gang had killed them, and the message had travelled. Somebody must have escaped, or somebody getting to know about it, and. It got so bad that one gang wouldn't unite with another gang. They were terrified of them. And this fella that came to me, he had gangrene on his thigh. He'd been pinching cabbages off a farm to feed the gang. And this farmer had come out and fired his shotgun and caught him in the thigh. And it had turned gangrenous. And he'd lived on his own. He couldn't find the gang anymore. They'd scattered. And he'd lived on his own. And by the time we caught him, he'd made his way back to his father's land, and he was on his hands and knees. And you couldn't believe this, but his incisor teeth had started to grow over his lip. He was slavering. He was dressed in animal skins, So he'd snared animals, but he hadn't cooked them. He'd skinned them, and he'd put the fur side inside and the raw side outside. So he was dressed in these skins that stumped a high oven, and his hair had really gone long. He looked like an animal. As I say, he was on his hands and knees in his father's area. So he was caught and brought in, and sat him again the fire, but you couldn't sit again the fire with him. It was, because it's cold up in the mountains, you know. And I got the cook to give him uji, which is like maize porridge. Give him a plate of uji. Oh, and he scoffed that. And give him a tambi, a cigarette, like, give him a cigarette. And then slowly but surely, he couldn't actually speak to start with. And suddenly he started to say the odd word or two, like, and he says the fire was lovely. He didn't light a fire because that might bring the Mzungu on him. And he was chuffed to bits to be caught, really, like. And when I went to, we took him to hospital, and he went into hospital in Navy, and we went to see him there. He had his leg all in plaster, and he put a hell of a lot of weight on, and he couldn't see a happy and nice looking fellow.
And who was he?
Yeah, I couldn't remember his name, but he was a Mau Mau, you know, he's one of the Mau Mau. And he'd been given the job of pinching cabbages off this farm down in the lowlands. And he'd been shot trying to do it. And he couldn't find his way back. He'd moved. The gang had moved.
Why do you think that they wanted to start the Mau Mau or join the Mau Mau?
Well, the way I understood it was, the British colonists, they went there and they just took whatever land they wanted. From where they stood to as far as the eye could see. And eventually, the Kikuyu people were getting moved off their lands, although they didn't cultivate it very good. They didn't have any great knowledge on cultivation. So, I think what happened was they took the Kikuyu people because they were the brightest people, and they for council offices and government jobs and things like that, and they taught them. So they became the most educated of their tribes, because there's quite a number of tribes in Kenya, but they became the most quick to learn and all that. But once they got to learn, it was them that decided that they would create a force to try and cause discontent to become independent. I think it was just the knowledge. They gained enough knowledge to think they could run their own country. And they hated the idea of the white man saying, right, as far as I can see, that's mine. You'll have to move off. So they were pushing the Kikuyu further and further up the mountains, where they were having to clear the land and fight the boar from pinching the peas and the potatoes and the monkeys from eating the peas. So they had a hell of a job on the Kikuyu people trying to live, where the rich man was filling his country with cattle and God knows what, you know, the pyrethrum growers and all this sort of thing, making a fortune.
How did you get on with the Kikuyu?
I found them quite nice people, funny people. If you wanted to talk to them, you had to be prepared to talk for 2 or 3 days. They used to talk all around the houses, and that's the way it was. They had to be prepared to sit and listen. And as I say, you had to have an interpreter, because not very many white people spoke Kikuyu at the time. But they spoke Swahili as well, mind. Yeah.
So you wouldn't get a direct answer from them?